This is Radioactive Magazine, a KKFI public affairs program of progressive activism, opinion, and commentary. Opinions expressed on this program are those of the speakers alone and are not necessarily the views of KKFI, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, show hosts, or other guests on the program.
Okay, this is Craig Lubo, and thank you for joining us on Radioactive Magazine. And my guest tonight is Laura O'Sullivan, and she is with the Midwest Innocence Project. Welcome, Laura.
Thank you for having me.
And we're going to be talking about wrongful convictions and what leads to them and some case examples. If you can, if you can tell the listeners, what does Midwest Innocence Project do?
Sure. We accept letters from people who are in prison having been convicted of crime. When they write to us, basically what they say is that they're actually innocent and they need our help. These are people who have already appealed their conviction. They've already done kind of all of the normal everyday things to try and challenge their cases. And we are kind of their place of last resort, their last chance to have somebody look into their case. We look at the case and determine whether or not they are somebody that we could perhaps find new evidence to show that they did not commit the crime and that they're actually innocent and should not be in prison.
And you work with UMKC students too, is that correct?
I do. I'm actually a professor over there at University of Missouri, Kansas City Law School, and I work with the students there. We have a Midwest Innocence Project clinic, and so the students work with me there. I also drive over to Columbia, to the University of Missouri Law School in Columbia, and I have a group of students over there that also work in the clinic, and in addition, I have two journalism students that will be joining me this semester to spread across the state wherever we need them to try and investigate these cases.
Okay, and we were talking before we came on the air, there are some other Innocence Projects in the region, including the one at KU. Can you tell us a little bit what the difference is between what your office does and what the one that KU does?
Sure, yeah. The Midwest Innocence Project covers a six-state region. So we work in Missouri, Kansas, Nebraska, Arkansas, Missouri. I know I missed somebody there. I'll figure it out in a minute. But we work only for people who are actually innocent. In Kansas, their law school has a clinic that works with it's a post-conviction clinic that works on both innocence cases and people who have been convicted, but for reasons other than innocence, should get some sort of relief. So they have maybe a broader mission than we do.
Okay. What would some examples be of relief situations not involving an innocence claim?
They may, for example, a few years ago, there was a project I know that some of the universities throughout Missouri were working on with battered women who had been sentenced to lengthy sentences. So it was kind of a proportionality review of whether or not that was whether or not their sentences were harsher than they should have been, or whether their claims of self-defense should have been looked at more carefully. Things like that that may be post-conviction claims but are not specifically innocence claims.
So one example, I guess, would be that case actually from Florida where we heard on the news during the Zimmerman trial where that lady was convicted of shooting the gun into the air to fend off her husband.
Right.
And she drew, I think, a 20-year sentence for
right.
defending
so
herself.
It might be something like that. It also might be something like a case where somebody was convicted and there was some sort of misconduct. For example, prosecutors had evidence that they should have turned over that they didn't, and maybe the person isn't claiming actual innocence but is saying they were convicted of something of a worse crime than they actually committed. So
and What are some of the common factors that you see in these cases as far as why they are wrongful convictions to begin with?
Some of them I think the public probably is aware of, things like eyewitness identification and how unreliable that can be. Obviously, if somebody once goes to trial and their attorney doesn't do a good enough job, that can get an innocent person convicted. Similarly, if a person goes to the trial and the prosecution doesn't turn over information that would lead to finding that information that proves their innocence, that would get an innocent person convicted. The things that I found really interesting was how often people are convicted after having falsely confessed. That happens in quite a few cases. And the frequency with which people testify at trial falsely, they're perjuring themselves. So informant testimony, somebody in prison or in jail who's trying to get something, you know, a benefit for their testimony, somebody testifying at trial who is kind of trying to help the case and may exaggerate what they know, may embellish what they know, and lead to an innocent person being convicted that shouldn't have been convicted.
Okay. And what are some of the things that we can do to help prevent those?
Well, and I just realized one important one that I didn't mention just a minute ago was junk science or inaccurate science that can also lead to innocent people being wrongfully convicted. Some of the things that we can do certainly are make sure that the prosecutors are handing over the information that they need to be handing over. Similarly, that the defense attorneys are doing a good enough job. We need to make sure that all sides are getting the resources that they need to do a good job, the resources, the time. I know there's been a lot of discussion lately about funding of the public defender's office, and those are the types of things when defense counsel doesn't have enough time or money to look into, to investigate the case at the beginning, that can certainly lead to innocent people spending a long time in prison. We need to be looking at the science that is being introduced in court and really start asking the question, is it science? You know, from a citizen's perspective, when you are called to jury duty, I think we all need to be holding the state to their burden of proof, and we need to be asking the questions that need to be asked. So when that witness is up there, really analyzing their believability and what they're saying.
How do you get around, as an example, you mentioned eyewitness identification problems, and over in Kansas, we're very limited. We essentially were pretty much precluded from having experts testify about eyewitness identification. So how do you bring that out when you have a state law that, for lack of a better way of saying it, is stacked against the defendants?
Right, and just as you said that, I smiled because this is one of my frustrations. Eyewitness identification is the most unreliable testimony there is. It really has led to, as of today, we've had 1,284 innocent people exonerated since 1989. That's a lot of people who did a lot of time. Average length of time they served before they're released is over 13 years. So that's a lot of time in prison for a lot of innocent people. And some numbers have 75% of those cases involving misidentification. People getting up on the stand and testifying and pointing that person out, and we know that that's just not true. So as as citizens, we need to know that. We need to understand that that testimony is unreliable, and you need to listen to the rest of the case. If there isn't any more, then I think you really need to question whether or not the state has met their burden to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. I myself believe that experts should be allowed to testify about eyewitness identification on its and the things that go into whether or not it's reliable. There are things that can be done that would make it or help make it more reliable. So things like, for example, if a police officer is putting together a lineup of people, let's make sure they all resemble each other. You know, that's a simple thing. The other thing that can be done is that the person who's putting together, for example, a photo lineup should not be the person who knows, they shouldn't know who the suspect is. The person who shows the lineup to a person shouldn't know who the suspect is. We give nonverbal cues. Sometimes we accidentally tip off a person, and those are the things that lead to wrongful identifications. And once somebody has made a wrongful identification, the research shows that they're going to believe and stick to that identification. So I think we really need to look at that testimony. It'd be helpful if we had instructions that we could give to jurors so that they could determine how am I supposed to analyze this testimony. But you know, if I could say anything else about this to the general public, it would be, and the people that would be serving as jurors, it would be, you know, to really take a step back. If that's the only testimony that they have, I would be really very, very cautious.
As an example, I've seen some photo identification lineups over in Wyandotte County where, for instance, if my client is African American and they'll have six pictures of six black males, and oftentimes the only resemblance between any of them is the fact that they're black. Mm-hmm. Other than that, they have no resemblance, and so it's almost as if the detective is intentionally picking, he'll have the one that he thinks is guilty in there, and somehow probably steering the witness to identify that one.
Well, and you know, the steering portion of it can be intentional or unintentional. You know, I mean, it can happen both ways. But I have seen, obviously, we've seen some really terrible lineups. And, you know, part of the lineup process is supposed to be getting similarly looking individuals. They're supposed to be consistent with some sort of description. And so when you have a lineup where you see the only, you know, they're Caucasians, but you have, you know, some with facial hair and some without facial hair, some with you know, some bald, some not. I saw one lineup where it was six pictures, but only three different people. Well, you know, I mean, that's not a lineup of six. And they've done some interesting studies about that where if individuals look at that type of lineup and two of the people are inconsistent with the description, you know, while it may look like a lineup of six, it's really a lineup of four. And so that innocent person that was one of six is now really one of four. And it becomes an identification of exclusion rather than the identification of the perpetrator, meaning they just start excluding the rest of the pictures until they come up with the one that looks sort of most like who they think it should be. And then people sometimes want to be a good witness, and they say, that's got to be the guy. There he is. And what we don't want is identifications of exclusion.
Okay. And you mentioned false confessions, too. In the few states now, they are requiring, or have begun to require, that police interrogations be videotaped. Is that being done in Missouri?
It is being done in Missouri for in murder cases, and when they have the equipment and everything is working. It's really important that we get these statements on videotape so that the people who have the ultimate job of making that decision can see the statement and make their own evaluation of what that person is saying. So, yes, it is being done.
What is the rationale that the legislators have given to limit that to murder cases?
Cost.
But that would probably help in other types of cases.
Sure, it would help wherever we can do it.
Right.
And I'm not saying that they don't do that in other cases.
Okay. And why is false confessions a problem? And I guess let me, because that may sound odd the way I phrase that. Why do defendants tend to give false confessions? Yes, is what I'm asking.
Sure. And you know, when we talk about false confessions, the interesting thing is that can often involve not a confession that one might think of typically, but it can involve just a sentence that looks like it's incriminating. So we'll include kind of incriminating statements all the way to full confessions. You know, I think people understand that maybe people who have mental illnesses might give a statement saying that they did something that they didn't do. That I think we can wrap our heads around that. Juveniles, of course, are particularly susceptible to give statements and to confess crimes that they did not commit. People who are under the influence of alcohol or drugs are more likely to give a false statement. But the interesting thing, as we have collected information about innocent people who have been wrongfully convicted, is that innocent people, adults not suffering from a mental health problem, who are not under the influence of drugs or alcohol, also sometimes confess to crimes that they did not commit. And we see this, and we see that happening from when we have extensive, lengthy interrogations. Sometimes people confess thinking, well, I'll just get it cleared up after I get out of this room, once I get my lawyer, or once I get my family involved. And what we find is that doesn't happen.
And how do you get, because you talked about the drugs issue in some of those situations, how do we establish and convince a jury that the drugs actually had an influence on the confession? So I have, for example, I had a 1507 appeal in Kansas at one time, and this guy had been completely washed out on crack cocaine. Used it probably a dozen times in a two-day period. Probably didn't even really comprehend what his own name was, but somehow could talk. And so you have the detective saying, oh, he knew what he was saying, and the jury bought that.
Mm-hmm.
So what are some tips to, if a jury is going to buy into something like that, how do you deal with that?
Well, hopefully the jury won't. you know, I think one thing that would help, obviously, in that circumstance would be to have the videotape, because then you can see the person as they give the statement. That would, of course, help. In the absence of that, what does a trial attorney do with that kind of statement? You know, I think that it's important to consult with experts and to ask the questions, you know, how does, you know, first, of course, you have to talk to your client and find out what were they ingesting, how much, how often. And then it's very important to just kind of not rely on your own assumptions or understanding, but to really go and consult with an expert and find out what these drugs do, how they affect the person, how they might affect their ability to understand what's happening, how they might, you know, result in hallucinations, delusions, all of those things. And I think you've got to get that in front of the jury. You need, jurors want that information. They want to be able to be fully informed of everything before they make those kinds of determinations.
Okay. And can you tell us a little bit about some of the cases that you're working on presently or have worked on?
I can tell you a little bit about what's been happening over the last year. In June of this year, June 12th to be exact, I went with a couple of students and the workers at the Midwest Innocence Project up to the penitentiary in Cameron, and Robert Nelson walked out of the prison doors after almost 30 years in prison. He was a gentleman who had been wrongfully convicted in Jackson County, and the prosecutor and I worked collaboratively and cooperatively to analyze the evidence, the forensic evidence. We actually did a lot of DNA testing. So the Kansas City Crime Lab here in town did a bunch of DNA testing, and then we sent off some items to another laboratory to do a different type of DNA testing. And together those results identified the two actual perpetrators. So they were able to determine who actually committed the crime. And the prosecutor and I agreed to Mr. Nelson's release. In the meantime, the police were going about locating one of the individuals that we had identified to arrest him. The other person was already in prison for a similar crime. And so Robert walked out, and he has a very loving and wonderful family who he was able to move in with family. He got a driver's license. When he got in the car, when he last got into a car, the window would roll down manually. And so you think about these things, and he had never used an iPhone. So I'm the proud recipient of his first text message. But, you know, it's a whole different world after that amount of time. And he's got a job, and he's doing well, quietly living his life. Mm-hmm. So that's exciting. The other thing that we were working on was I had written what we call a friend of the court pleading with the Court of Appeals in the Ryan Ferguson case. We had also hosted a panel discussion at UMKC Law School with all of the attorneys who had represented Ryan through the years.
I attended that.
Yeah, so that was kind of an interesting, different panel. And Aaron Moriarty from 48 Hours was on the panel as well. And we talked a lot about all of the different things that had occurred in his case. And he was, Kathleen Zellner and Doug Johnson were his attorneys, and he, of course, was just released recently. The other case that we're working on is, I argued a case.
I've got one question.
Sure.
On that, because you mentioned Aaron Moriarty. Mm-hmm. From CBS News, and they did a show, and PBS did a show on him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't recall. I think
Dateline did some shows.
Yes,
on
NBC.
Mm-hmm.
If you're dealing with somebody who a case where there isn't that notoriety for whatever reason, and you don't get that publicity, does that make it harder? Did having that publicity help? Did it make potential difference in Ryan's case?
Of course, we don't know. I think, you know, we have, most of our cases do not get that kind of notoriety. We have a case in St. Louis that certainly has been covered by the local media, but nothing like the coverage that was occurring in the Ferguson case. I think that coverage is incredibly important for other innocent people. Did it make a difference in the decision in Ryan's case? I'm not really sure that it did. The facts of that case very clearly revealed that information, we call it exculpatory information, or information that tends toward proving his innocence, was hidden from him. And when that happens, the courts are not happy and usually will give some sort of relief. In his case, every witness that had testified against him had changed their testimony, recanted it, and explained why that had happened. So I think when it came to the Court of Appeals, which I believe, if I'm right, it was his 13th challenge to that case, which kind of gives you an idea of how hard it is to get relief, I think by that time the evidence was so clear that the court really, I mean, this was the right decision. Was it influenced by the media? I don't know that it was. I would have thought, you know, if you were going to speculate that the media had some influence, you would have thought that influence would have been more at the trial court level, at the initial habeas mm-hmm. hearing. And so, I don't know.
you mentioned, I think, Arkansas is one of the states that...
Yes.
Okay. Was your office involved in that West Memphis 3 case at all?
We were not. We were very happy to co-host a reading that Damien Eccles did of his book when he came to Unity Temple and read a portion, and there was question and answer. But we were not in any way involved in that case.
Okay. And what as citizens, if people who are listening who are not attorneys and might want to know what they can do to help change this process?
Well, I think the first thing I would like is for people to educate themselves on these issues. And, of course, we have a website where we explain the different causes and what happens. It's themip.org. So if you just want to educate yourself on that, there's that website. In addition, you can always volunteer. And we're in the process of taking volunteer applications and getting together a group of people to help. We hold periodic events, so if you follow us on Facebook or Twitter, then you know you can educate yourself on the issues. The other thing is, you know, I think it is important for us as a society to pay attention to requests for legislative change and to understand that these cases take a long time to get this evidence in front of a court, and that the incidence of innocent people in prison is uncomfortably high, and we need to be open to looking at these cases and making a different decision and being okay with saying there was a mistake made and we need to correct that mistake.
And what is, I know there's a lot of cases that are not, do not involve the DNA evidence. When you do have DNA evidence, what is the process to be able to get a new trial using that DNA evidence?
We file a motion with the court requesting that the court allow us to test that evidence. Sometimes we can go to the prosecutor and start that process without having to file the motion. More often than not, we file a motion and ask the court to order that we be allowed access to the evidence and to test that evidence. Interestingly, over 70% of the cases where people have been proven innocent don't involve DNA at all. So I think a lot of people think, well, you know, those cases have DNA and that's how people are being proven innocent. Actually, the majority of cases, that's not the case. So.
No. All right, I believe we're about out of time. Thank you for joining us. And you've been listening to Radioactive Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
You have been listening to Radioactive Magazine, a locally produced broadcast spotlighting social and political activists in our community. If you'd like more information or like to comment on this program, call Bill Claus at 816-994-7869.